You are listening to a sermon by Rosie Pereira, recorded on Sunday, November 5th, 2017, at the Point Grey Inter-Mennonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only, and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
Thank you for the selection of hymns. Many of those dovetailed exactly with what I'm going to be talking about. And some revealed new things that I hadn't mentioned. So it's good that all of that brings together the message. And Henry, you stole my thunder a little bit. My introduction was going to be this Sunday, a sandwich between Reformation Day and Peace Sunday. Great bookends for a day of thinking about moral outrage. Otherwise known as righteous indignation. And Henry already talked about Luther, so I don't need to tell that bit. Luther had a reputation for being a bit of a hothead. Some of you may have heard the story of him throwing the ink pot against the wall when he thought he had been woken up by the devil in the middle of the night, who was tormenting him. And he's also known for his writings that are filled with invective against the Pope and calling him the Antichrist, and comparing his utterances to vulgar bodily functions, which are unmentionable in church. A Jesuit blogger named Nick Courtney says that some of us might think of Luther as the patron saint of righteous indignation. It's a very timely one at that, I might add, due to all the moral outrage we see online and in political discourse these days. Courtney continues, were Luther posting his theses today, we might expect him to use Twitter, or at least for the theses to quickly go viral. The approach of Peace Sunday, which we celebrate on Remembrance Day, is another motivation for thinking about moral outrage. A few years ago, I bought this white poppy pin online to wear at this time of year when others wear the red poppy. This is a symbol of peace, of longing for peace instead of war. I thought I was being a good Mennonite to do that. But this week, I was saddened by seeing a video online that called out those who wear the poppy for a pacifist reason as being disrespectful to those who have given the ultimate sacrifice. And there were all kinds of really nasty comments on there about, if I see you wearing a white poppy, I will rip it off of you and dig it, grind it into the ground with my foot. If you're not respectful, leave this country, and things like that. So I was very saddened and felt that it was disappointing to me to see that that kind of vitriolic patriotism had migrated north of the border. I couldn't associate that with more my country back home. But anyway, Canada is not immune from that kind of thing. The third and primary reason I chose this day to speak on this subject is that today is the closest Sunday to the anniversary of the election of the current holder of the presidential office in the United States, someone who I struggle with a lot with my own moral outrage towards. With nearly daily reports of yet another tweet or behavior that reaches new lows of decency, I struggle to maintain my equanimity and to focus on how I am called to respond to injustices I see. I am easily swept up in the social media frenzy of heaping recrimination and ridicule on him and his enablers, and I find myself dragged down into the mire, unable to do anything productive with my anger. So I have done a lot of thinking about how we as Christians respond to things in the world that upset our sense of righteousness, whether it be war, racism, injustice, or political actions which we find to be counter to God's will. When is righteous anger justified? And when does it cross the line into self-righteousness and contempt? There's a little handout which I'm not going to refer to at all, but just for you to take home with. It's kind of a humorous poster about when is moral outrage justified. And basically, most of the time, not, unless it's God's people being persecuted and there's something you can do about it. But there's a lot of other reasons why people do get up in arms unnecessarily. How can we channel moral outrage productively rather than letting it fester inside us to the point that it poisons our own souls? And what is a more appropriate response as Christians, particularly Mennonites, to harm that we see being done, sometimes even in the name of Christ. I don't claim to have definitive answers, but I want to make a start towards a few and open up the discussion. Let's back up a moment for a definition of moral outrage. One writer describes it as a type of anger triggered by the violation of a moral principle by a person or entity that has no direct relationship to the observer. This differs from just plain old anger. If someone mistreats me or my family, I might get angry. But if someone mistreats a complete stranger, I might be morally outraged. In this way, moral outrage is thought to be a method of maintaining or enforcing certain societal norms. There are examples of moral outrage in the scriptures that are presented as good or acceptable. We looked at one of them in our readings today. Jesus was zealously angry that the temple, his father's house, had become a marketplace. In Matthew, the term is a den of thieves or a den of robbers. He expressed that righteous anger physically, driving out the animal vendors and money changers and overturning their tables. What were the merchants doing in the temple in the first place? And why was it problematic? One commentator explains the background. Animal vendors sold the various creatures that were to be sacrificed. Money changers enabled worshippers to change some of their everyday money into Jewish currency to pay the half-shekel temple tax. This essential service came about because the use of Roman or Greek coins with their blasphemous imagery, some Roman coins declared Caesar to be divine, was prohibited in the temple. Traditionally, the various stalls selling animals and changing money had been located nearby in the Kidron Valley or on the slopes of the Mount of Olives. There's some evidence that the practice of setting up shop within the confines of the temple may have been a fairly recent development, allowed by Caiaphas, the high priest himself. It was not, however, unprecedented in the history of the people of Israel. In fact, the book of Zechariah envisions a future in which there would be no longer traitors in the house of the Lord. So Jesus is acting in the prophetic tradition. In Mark's account, Jesus says, "Is it not written, 'My house shall be called a house of prayer for all nations, but you have made it a den of thieves'?" We usually look to Christ as a role model to emulate. But in this story, is Jesus showing us that it's okay to act with such forceful emotion and put a stop to evil we observe? Well, he was God for one thing, and we're not. The passage continues beyond where we read this morning with the Jews responding, "What sign can you show us to prove your authority to do all this?" And he gives them the enigmatic statement, "Destroy this temple, and I will raise it again in 3 days." And he was referring to the temple of his body, which would be raised from the dead. Elsewhere, John the Baptist expressed moral outrage at the Pharisees and the Sadducees, the religious elitists, when he called them a brood of vipers and called down God's wrath upon them if they would not turn from their wicked ways. Jesus also got angry at the religious leaders and called them blind guides, fools, hypocrites, and, I love the King James translation of this, whited sepulchres, which means whitewashed graves. The important thing to note about all these instances is that Jesus was denouncing their self-righteousness. They had set themselves up as the moral watchdogs of the day, but they were missing out on the spirit of the law, putting oppressive expectations on the people and not lifting a finger to help them. When we get self-righteously outraged at others' sins, we risk being the target of God's anger. The story of the Pharisee and the tax collector, which we read today, is a good reminder of God's preferred posture towards unrighteousness. We ought to be more concerned about our own than that of others. We also have negative examples in the Bible when moral outrage leads people to take justice into their own hands, and they cross a line that only God can cross. When Peter cut off the ear of the high priest's servant the night of Jesus' arrest, Jesus tells him, "No, put away your sword," and he heals the man. That's a little detail that is in one of the other Gospels. It's important that moral outrage not lead us to seek vengeance. In Romans 12:19, we hear that God says, "Vengeance is mine, and I will repay." The prophets, who were angry at people's behavior, did not take it upon themselves to bring retribution upon them, but merely warned them of God's judgment if they would not repent. Wes Alamon writes a philosophical blog called The Partially Examined Life, and he talks about the moral uselessness of moral outrage in one of his entries. Many opinion makers, he says, feel the need, in light of the latest act of terrorism or some other injustice, to proclaim publicly that such acts are outrageous, disgusting, and cowardly. They are concerned that if they don't testify loudly enough, people will think they are on the wrong side of a very stark dividing line. The societal outrage ratchets up until all of us are expected to pledge our hatred, not just for such acts, but for their perpetrators. The problem is that such outrage eventually breeds the very same kinds of behavior we are outraged at. Alwyn calls this an extension of Plato's no one knowingly does evil theorem. The idea is that every act, no matter how horrible it seems to us, makes total sense to the person doing it, and they think they are doing it for good reasons, inspired by their own moral outrage. When we respond with outrage to such outrage-fueled crimes, we may be driven by the anxiety that silence is implicit endorsement, but our outrage achieves precisely the opposite of the distancing to which it aspires, by replicating in our own minds the state of mind of the perpetrators. One article presents evidence that the roots of moral outrage are, in part, self-serving. Expressing moral outrage can serve as a form of personal advertisement. People who invest time and effort in condemning those who behave badly are trusted more. This helps address an evolutionary mystery. Why would a selfless tendency like moral outrage result from the selfish process of evolution? One important piece of the answer is that expressing moral outrage actually does benefit you in the long run by improving your reputation. This is related to a phenomenon known as virtue signaling, which is a term I learned through this research and never heard it before. But when we take some symbolic action to show others how righteous we are in comparison to those others, those tax collectors, we are looking for approval from our in-group. We may be expressing solidarity with an injured party, like when people change their Facebook profile image to have background colors of a country that's recently experienced a terrorist attack. Even wearing a poppy, be it red or white, is a form of this. Not that it's bad, but let's just be mindful of our motivations. By the way, I forgot to explain that I did, after this, seeing this interchange online that was so negative, I did go ahead and buy a red poppy because the people were making the point that veterans services do benefit from people buying these red poppies. So I went ahead and I paid double what the recommended donation was. Does moral outrage drive social progress? It is commonly believed that moral progress rides on waves of moral outrage. Upon experiencing moral outrage, it is thought people become motivated to speak up, act out, and take action to correct the injustice and to defend the downtrodden. But Michael McCullough believes that moral outrage is an illusion. It is feigned and often doesn't result in action. I've seen the term faux outrage used online. He cites an experiment which shows that people aren't willing to sacrifice some of their own money to see a perpetrator punished for taking money from a stranger. So they may be outraged at it, but when it comes to them having to pay something about that, they're not willing. We may make a lot of noise about being, quote, mad as hell about something, but it's all bark and no bite. We don't follow through. Another aspect of moral outrage is that the things which aggravate us most about other people are often things we are guilty of ourselves. Romans 2:1 says, "Therefore, you have no excuse, whoever you are, when you judge others. For in passing judgment on another, you condemn yourself, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things." The story we read in 2 Samuel depicts David getting morally outraged at the behavior of the rich man in Nathan's parable. But Nathan explains it to him, and David recognizes his own guilt and responds in proper repentance. I have observed in my own life that those who don't actually get involved in doing something about an injustice that angers them experience more negative emotional effects from moral outrage than those who do. I have a Regent alum friend who founded an organization to help girls and women who are sexually trafficked. And another has started a ministry to help the church in reconciliation with First Nations. I admire such people. Meanwhile, I am one of those who tends to engage in what's called armchair activism, sitting in front of the computer and forwarding articles around and tweets that are about this or that appalling thing that the current president of the United States has done. looking for approval from my like-minded friends and from likes on Facebook. Is it any wonder that I feel impotent and angry and down on myself? So where do we go from here? I have 5 suggestions. When you feel the object of your moral outrage colonizing your mind, fast from the things that cause you to get irate. Social media, news. Jesus said, if your eye causes you to stumble, pluck it out. That's in Mark 9:47. So for myself, I commit to taking a break from the internet, the news, and social media that get me riled up, because that is the only thing that really works for me. Number 2, pray for your, quote, enemies, and by extension, those who do injustice to others. Jesus called us to love our enemies and pray for them in Matthew 5:44. He also said of his own enemies, Father, forgive them, for they know not what they are doing. That's in Luke 6:34. Number 3, deal with it liturgically before God. And that idea comes from David Taylor's article explaining Miroslav Volf reflecting on Psalm 137, which is one of the so-called imprecatory psalms. Those are the psalms which call God's justice down upon evildoers. There is precedent for using these psalms in the context of the whole church and worship of God, but that is not licensed to take the sentiments out of context. And parenthetically, along with that point, I wanted to draw attention to one of the earlier hymns that you had us read, which talked about the church acting in a prophetic role when it sees wrongdoing. So that is different than us individually railing about something. If the church collectively speaks out about it, that is a way for us to channel our outrage. Number 4, find something that you can do to channel the outrage into doing something positive that relates to the thing that angers you. This is one that I admit I'm still not there yet. I haven't really found something that I could volunteer for or that I can put my own time into that really acts on the things that I find myself getting angry about in the political realm. And finally, lament. Going back to Wes Alwyn, who I cited earlier, he says, how do we motivate ourselves to fight against society's frequent injustices if not through outrage? The alternative, he says, to outrage is sadness. Sadness is not as exciting as outrage, and it doesn't confer the same protective feelings of toughness. Nevertheless, it's a more mature state of mind that leads to better consequences for society while sufficiently honoring the moral issues involved. More constructive than outrage at the latest villain or some perceived injustice is to acknowledge the sad state of humanity and get on with the task of trying to understand and improve it. Tasks for which moral outrage is absolutely useless.